evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan, Sudan, and the rest of the region this Monday, November 18th, 2024. South Sudanese health officials say they're responding to a cholera outbreak.
Cholera continues to pose a significant public health challenge in South Sudan, intensified by ongoing humanitarian crisis on constrained access to clean water and situation due to our complex situation.
And some South Sudanese teens at COP29 say heat waves forced them out of school.
All the children who were in schools were out of school for 2 weeks, and this really affected me because this year I'm sitting for my national exams.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. 6 people in South Sudan are now confirmed dead after the National Health Ministry declared a cholera outbreak in late October. The Ministry of Health says it has reestablished an incident management system with the National Incident Management Team to ensure an immediate multi-sector response. Dennis Ligonier reports for VOA from Juba.
The Minister of Health says the government has secured more than 150,000 doses of oral cholera vaccine from an international coordinating group after the October 28th declaration of an outbreak in rank of Upper Nile State. The Minister of Health has once declared a wider cholera outbreak in South Sudan. On Sunday, Health Minister Yolanda Awel-Deng spoke to journalists at the Emergency Operations Center.
Cholera continues to pose a significant public health challenge in South Sudan, intensified by ongoing humanitarian crisis on constrained access to clean water and situation due to our complex situation. The outbreak that started in Reng has spread to Juba and Malakala as well as other areas that are waiting to be confirmed, with 243 suspected cases, 27 culture positive confirmed cases, and 6 fatalities, representing a case fatality rate of 2.5% as of November 14, 2024.
Awel-Deng says a contributing factor to the spread of cholera in Juba has been the increasing number of refugees and returnees escaping the Sudan war. Peter Daniel is deputy chairperson of the Camp Management Committee at the Protection of Civilian Site in Juba, which hosts about 70,000 people.
The people coming from Khartoum, Uganda and Kenya, most of them come here because they do not have a place outside there. That's why we request the government to do fencing to prevent the cholera from spreading, because if it happens, it will be a great danger to the civilians in POC. The POC is congested with people, and it is not like other residential areas where everyone lives free in a compound.
Daniel says all temporary houses in the camp are very close to each other. The health ministry is calling on its partners to join in efforts to prevent further spread of the disease.
The Minister of Health seeks the collaboration of the line ministries of water, environment, information, education, plus other stakeholders to address underlying wash challenges and support ongoing intervention. The short-term cholera vaccination strategy, providing up to 3 years of protection, is a crucial component of our broader response efforts.
Awel-Deng says they are supporting infection prevention and control, improving water, sanitation and hygiene, known as wash, and administering targeted vaccinations. Peter Daniel says his camp is still faced with issues of sanitation and hygiene. He wants the ministry to help them out before the situation becomes worse.
Regarding the issue of cleaning here in POC, there are challenges facing us. First of all, there are no vehicles that can take the garbage. All the garbage are thrown behind the camp, but for the garbage to be taken, there is no any vehicle. But when UN was here, there were vehicles that take the garbage. And other organizations that deals in public health also take the garbage. But after all the organizations left, there were no vehicles that come to take the garbage. And also the vehicles in Juba do not reach here, and this is dangerous to the civilians in POC.
Anita Kikigbeho, UN Deputy Special Representative of the Secretary General and Humanitarian Coordinator in South Sudan, says she will meet with humanitarian partners to chart the way forward.
A lot of the work is around prevention, it's around awareness raising, it's around logistics, it's around food security, it's around water. Concretely, discussions are underway at the moment for a example, in rank to decongest the camp. The multi-sectoral coordination is key.
Cholera is an acute diarrheal infection caused by ingestion of food or water. It remains a global threat to public health and an indicator of a lack of social development. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logonye reporting from Juba.
The Global Climate Change Conference, known as COP29 in Baku, Azerbaijan, entered its final week today with no clear path on an agreement for financing to battle climate change. Less developed regions, including Africa, are asking richer countries to provide more money so that they can protect their countries against extreme weather and transition into renewable energy systems. Darren Taylor reports.
The delegates at COP29 widely agree that the world's poorest countries need trillions of dollars to cope with climate-related disasters and build clean energy capacity. They agree that rich industrialized countries are most responsible for the carbon fuel emissions causing the earth to get hotter. But so far there's no agreement on specific amounts of funding and which countries should pay up. South African Environment Minister Dion George is one of the continent's negotiators. He spoke to reporters on the sidelines of the annual meeting.
We need honest conversations. You know, you either want to have a transition or you don't. And if you're a developed economy country, well, you had the benefit of burning coal for hundreds of years. You know, we're not going to actually do that. So, you know, where is the justice in that? And how do you actually then look at the financial implications of that? So we're very clear. We're very united in terms of this is what it is that we want to achieve. It's not about ganging up on developed economy countries, but it's basically saying, look, you did make specific promises, you have committed to doing certain things, now do what you say you will do. And if you're not going to do it, then say so, and we are able to then make a plan as best we can because we know what needs to be done.
Some delegates at COP29 aren't optimistic. They say the biggest polluters have in the past agreed to measures to stop global warming, but not implemented them. Speaking during a United Nations webinar on Saturday, the UN Special Rapporteur on Climate Change and Human Rights, Elisa Morguera, said it's been difficult to get wealthy countries to live up to their commitments.
We had some initial language that was agreed, for instance, of moving away from fossil fuels. But in fact, all the data showing that many countries are increasing their fossil fuel extractions. There's been commitment around reducing and, in fact, eliminating subsidies to fossil fuel industries, and that is also not the case. And this is one of the big issues underlying the question of finance. There is significant amounts of money available, but they're still going into the causes of climate change as opposed to the solutions.
Wealthy nations pledged in 2009 to provide $100 billion a year in climate funds to developing nations starting in 2020, a deadline that later was pushed to 2025. That goal was met and slightly exceeded in 2022, according to data from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Diplomats and activists spent last week making speeches and conferring in the background on the need for ambitious global action. Negotiations are expected to ramp up this week to reach agreement by the end of COP29 on Friday. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Some children from South Sudan who are at the UN Climate Change Conference in Baku spoke to Reuters news agency about how climate change has affected their lives. VOA's Kwame Afori narrates our story.
Some children from South Sudan who are at the UN Climate Change Conference in Baku spoke to Reuters news agency about how climate change has affected their lives. As she walked through some of the pavilions at COP29, 14-year-old Naomi said excessive heat waves in South Sudan have forced school children to stay home.
Yes, I was out of school. Let me say, all the children who were in schools were out of school for 2 weeks. And this really affected me because this year I'm sitting for my national exams. Yeah, this is my last year in secondary school. And it really affected me because being in the last class or being a candidate, you have to be determined to do other things like to focus on your studies and also get more time by the end of the year for personal and self-studies. And due to the heat waves, we were at home like for 2 weeks. We were not not able to concentrate because it was hot. The temperatures were really high. You have to focus more on reducing the temperatures of your body.
Naomi says she's frightened about what lies ahead for her South Sudan village.
I'm really worried about the future because we have been coming. Last year I came for COP and this year I'm here for COP and still we are not seeing much changes, especially in South Sudan.
A 17-year-old South Sudanese teenager named Siami at COP29 says she too had to stay home from school during a lengthy heat wave.
As the heat wave started, actually, we were in school, actually, and our country, you know, it's a developing country, so we do not have actually kind of resilient buildings to climate change, and we don't have ACs in school mostly, because most of the schools are private schools, let's say, and there's lack of funding. So when the heat wave started, we had to go back home. The schools were all closed in the country, not in a particular state, so we had to go home, and going back home, there you have to stay with your parents.
The aid group Save the Children arranged for three South Sudanese children to be at the climate summit. Heat waves and floods have shattered most schools in South Sudan at different times this year. Children attending the climate change summit are pushing world leaders to protect their education and their futures by agreeing to lower greenhouse gas emissions and providing money to poor nations like South Sudan to combat climate change.
A short time ago, Russia vetoed a United Nations Security Council resolution calling for an immediate end to hostilities in Sudan, where a war between two rival generals has been raging since April of 2023. The French news agency AFP says it had seen a draft of the resolution prepared by Britain and Sierra Leone, and reports it had called on both sides to immediately cease hostilities and begin talks on a national ceasefire. The 14 other Security Council members voted in favor of that measure. Russia is one of five permanent members of the Security Council that have veto powers. After the vote, British Foreign Secretary David Lammy condemned the veto. He said one country is the enemy of peace. This Russian veto is a disgrace, end quote. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up on South Sudan in Focus, cryptocurrency surges after Donald Trump is elected U.S. president. Find out more when we come back. Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies have surged on the expectation the Trump administration will be crypto-friendly. Bitcoin jumped to a record high of $89,000 on Tuesday of last week. After Donald Trump won the U.S. presidential election, investors shoveled money into cryptocurrencies as Trump, who once derided the industry, is now an investor himself. Journalist Finn Miller, who writes about cryptocurrency in the online publication Solana Floor, tells me that Africans have been fans of cryptocurrency for years.
I think that throughout the crypto industry, a lot of people think that Trump's policies will support their asset value. So there's widespread kind of sentiment and consensus that a Trump administration is good for the industry.
But why is he good for the industry? Has he said things that are friendly toward the crypto world?
As part of his campaign, Trump kind of positioned himself as the crypto president. He famously went to the Bitcoin conference in Nashville to proclaim himself as the Bitcoin president, as the crypto president. And he basically, in his campaign, outlined a lot of supposedly strong policies for the crypto industry, which included, first of all, preparing a strategic Bitcoin reserve. He recently suggested that there would be no capital gains tax on American crypto assets, so that's any cryptocurrency that is created in the United States. He's pledged to create a crypto advisory council, which will help his administration make more educated and more informed decisions moving forward. And he's suggested that there'll be better relationships between crypto businesses and banking partners. Now, those are kind of four of the main reasons, but I think the overarching point is that the previous administration under Harris and Biden, the SEC made a regulation by enforcement campaign against the crypto industry as a whole and kind of targeted a lot of businesses like Coinbase, like Binance, without providing clear legislation around what and how crypto businesses should be operating as. So in that time, they made a lot of lawsuits and started a lot of legal procedures against crypto businesses
Well, it sounds like you're saying it's going to be deregulated a lot under the Trump administration. And the reason perhaps that the Biden-Harris administration had some more controls over is because isn't it true that it's kind of seen as like the black market and a lot of things that can't be sold? And I'm not talking just about drugs, but other things that cannot be sold on the regular market. They're sold cryptocurrency or Bitcoin and other types of cryptocurrency, right?
That can happen, but that can also happen with U.S. cash. So Brian Armstrong famously once, well, Brian Armstrong, who is the founder of Coinbase, which is one of the most popular cryptocurrency exchanges in the world, said that less than 1% of crypto transactions are used for illegal purposes. And compared to the U.S. cash percent of 4%, that's kind of a dramatically reduced number. So yes, crypto can be used for illegal reasons, but so can any currency, really.
What is cryptocurrency, if you can define it for us, and how is it currently regulated?
So cryptocurrency as a whole is a financial system built on a public ledger. So the idea behind Bitcoin is that the Bitcoin network is almost a public good in a sense that it's operated completely everywhere around the world. Anyone who has access to the internet has access to Bitcoin. No one owns it. No one controls it. It's operated by contributors to the network. And the cryptocurrency itself is just a way of maintaining governance and of powering that system so that everyone can use it. It's a collective push for a more decentralized financial system globally.
Because of what you just said, how it's not ruled by governments or owned by anyone, really, is cryptocurrency big in world markets like in Africa, where local currencies often fall victim to erratic governments, shaky governments? There's been coups. Are Africans getting involved in cryptocurrency?
Yeah, so Africans are hugely involved in cryptocurrency, and we see huge rates of cryptocurrency adoption in places like Argentina and Venezuela, where there are really poor kind of histories of financial interest rates were going really high. Huge rates of adoption in India and Pakistan. So in places where currencies typically are more volatile against the US dollar, crypto is exceedingly popular. And that's also because of access to stable coins, which are cryptocurrency assets that are pegged directly to the value of the US dollar. So in a lot of places like Nigeria, people have actually stopped transacting in the local currency, in the Naira, in favor of using US denominated stable coins.
That is Finn Miller, a journalist with the online publication Solana Floor. He was speaking with me from Paris. President-elect Trump will come into office in January 2025 with unified control of the U.S. Congress. Republicans will hold majorities in both the Senate and House as the result of a mandate from American voters. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more from Capitol Hill.
The new leader of the incoming Republican majority U.S. Senate. John Thune is the incoming Senate majority leader.
We have a mandate from the American people. A mandate not only to clean up the mess left by the Biden-Harris-Schumer agenda, but also to deliver on President Trump's priorities.
Thune takes the top leadership role in the Senate after Mitch McConnell served in that position for 18 years. And he is already facing his first test. President-elect Donald Trump has proposed bypassing the Senate's constitutional role of approving cabinet nominees. Senator John Thune.
The Senate has an advise and consent role under the Constitution, so we will do everything we can to process his noms quickly. Get them installed in their position so they can begin to implement his agenda.
Democrats lost their majority and will hold at least 47 seats in the new Senate. Chuck Schumer is the current majority leader in the U.S. Senate.
The American people have presented us with a challenge. We must learn from it.
Trump had unified control of government during the first 2 years of his first term. But one analyst says that does not always mean the White House will get what it wants on Capitol Hill. Casey Burgett is Legislative Affairs Program Director at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C.
Mitch McConnell had said then that he supports the president's agenda. He'll work with them. But then we saw from nominations to policies that they will provide no votes if they think the president has gone too far.
Republicans also secured a majority in the U.S. House of Representatives, earning praise from Trump.
It's nice to win.
The president-elect endorsed Speaker of the House Mike Johnson to lead again.
I believe it will be the most consequential Congress in the modern era, most consequential administration in the modern era, because, frankly, we have to fix almost every area of public policy.
But Republicans hold a much narrower majority in the House, with only a handful more seats than Democrats, who vowed to keep fighting. Democratic Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal.
The Congressional Progressive Caucus will continue to be ferocious defenders of the working class and poor people.
The new 119th U.S. Congress will be sworn into office on January 3rd.
Katherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
Voting took place peacefully across Senegal on Sunday. Roughly 7.3 million registered voters elected 165 members of parliament for five-year terms. Observers indicate the peaceful vote is a testament to a long democratic tradition in Senegal, widely seen as a stable outlier in a region plagued by coup d'etats. For the latest in yesterday's legislative election results, VOA's Yahyaas Wouhib talked to reporter Alpha Jallo in Dakar.
Yeah, Senegal has once again proven its democratic maturity during yesterday's legislative elections. Voting went very well. The polling stations opened on time, 8 a.m., and closed also at 6 p.m.
Very good. So the country's National Election Commission, SENA, has not officially announced the outcome, but Senegal's ruling party, PASTEF, is claiming a decisive victory in Sunday's legislative elections, securing a mandate for its reform agenda. So tell us about the outcome of the polls so far.
A very clear landslide victory for the ruling PASTEF party led by Prime Minister Ousmane Sonko. And this also marks a very pivotal moment in the country's political history. As you can recall, Mr. Sonko, Ousmane Sonko, is a firebrand politician. And I can tell you that he swept all the votes in major cities, even in the rural areas. In Dakar, which is Dakar has one of the biggest electorates here, but he swept all the polls here. But it is clear now that Mr. Ousmane Sonko is leading with a landslide victory, and even those analysts are saying that his party, which is PASTEF's party, is tipped to maybe get about 119. Parliamentary seat out of the 165 parliamentary seat.
So, Alpha, lastly, let's talk about the opposition. Former President Macky Sall leading an opposition group from abroad. Former Prime Minister and presidential runner-up Amadou Ba and Dakar Mayor Bartholomew Diaz. Any statements from them? Because they are actually saying that the government of Domam Faye is a government of inaction, amateurism, and a desire to settle scores with the previous administration.
Yes, they have been saying so many things. They have said so many bad things about Mr. Sonko, about Bassirou Diomaye Faye, that they are inexperienced, they cannot handle the country. But what makes this achievement even more remarkable is the reaction from the political, that is, opposition, like former Prime Minister Amadou Ba, the mayor of Dakar, Bartholomew Diaz, and even President Macky Sall himself, who graciously recognized the outcome of the elections, thereby reflecting a deep respect for the country's democratic value. So it is very clear now they have seen that Mr. Sonko is a very formidable politician. And this is also very clear. This will also give the government chance to start their reforms.
And lastly, Alpha, when is the country's National Election Commission officially going to announce the outcome?
Now, the SENA, which is the National Election Commission, will announce the final results either within 24 hours. That would be tomorrow or by Wednesday.
That's reporter Alpha Jallo speaking with my colleague Yahyaas Wouhib from Senegal's capital, Dakar. And that wraps it up for us this Monday. We encourage you to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you missed this broadcast, head on over to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with the song Salam Ya Sudan by Victoria Ole and Kasang Dedi. We've been listening to Salam Ya Sudan by Victoria Ole and Kasang Dedi. I am your host, Carol Van Dam in Washington. On behalf of our engineer, Peter Hundley, and producer, Kwame Afori, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you back here tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply concerned about violent, lethal attacks on civilians in Sudan by the Rapid Support Forces and the Sudanese Armed Forces, said U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas Greenfield.
In Darfur and more recently in Al Jazeera, reports indicate an alarming rise in widespread, targeted, ethnically motivated killings and mass atrocities by the RSF. In the Khartoum area in particular, SAF aerial bombings on markets and public places launched without any clear military objective have killed large numbers of civilians.
In light of the gravity of the situation in Sudan, the United States has four primary calls to action. First is the responsibility of all parties to this conflict to facilitate the flow of aid across all cross-border and cross-line routes, stressed Ambassador Thomas Greenfield.
We commend the Sudanese authorities for opening the Adre border crossing in mid-August. This single route allowed aid organizations to bring enough food, health, and nutrition supplies to serve more than 1.9 million people. Now Sudanese authorities must keep Adre border crossing open indefinitely. Millions of lives depend on it.
The second step is to bring an end to hostilities, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield.
All countries should cease providing military support to the belligerents, and every one of us must continue to press the parties to return to the negotiating table with the aim of ending this conflict.
The U.S. also supports the establishment of a compliance monitoring and verification mechanism following a broad cessation of hostilities agreement, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield.
Such a mechanism could ensure that international humanitarian law obligations and JEDA commitments are respected and implemented on the ground. And so this council and the international community writ large should empower African partners to lead on the establishment of such a mechanism, including by supporting scenario planning on design and deployment.
Finally, it is incumbent on the international community to support a transition to inclusive and democratic civilian governance. That includes seeking accountability for atrocities and other abuses committed over the past year and a half. We as the Security Council need to continue to pressure belligerents to end the violence now, declared Ambassador Thomas Greenfield, and to ensure life-saving aid reaches those in need, and to put Sudan on the path to democracy and security.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.